The police had followed her husband to our house, arrested him and started beating him up like really badly in our own back garden. And I can remember my mother running out and yelling at them, telling them to stop. And they literally turned around and said, well, if you don't shut up, we're going to hit you too.
Welcome to another episode of Higher Learning Season 2 with your host, Oz Rashid. We are dedicated to helping you build and lead world-class teams around the globe. Every Wednesday, we drop a new episode where I interview top leaders, people experts, and academics to discover what it takes to hire best-in-class talent. What do these executives do differently than everybody else? So today's episode, I'm very, very excited. We have a very special guest. We're joined by Kevin Stapp, a global HR and talent executive with an illustrious career. We're going to dive right into it. How you doing, Kevin?
Pretty good. Great to be here, Oz.
I'm so glad that you came on. We've known each other for a few years now, worked together a little bit. I'm so excited to dive into this with you. You are one of the best people to talk to about hiring and talent overall. So let's get right into it. You and I first started working together when you were an HR executive at Condé Nast. I'm always interested to understand our guests' professional journeys. So how did you get into HR in the first place? Is this something that you took, you knew you wanted to do when you were in your earlier school career, or was it something you fell into?
Yeah, you know, I think it was during my teenage years that I started getting an interest in HR. And I was born and raised in South Africa, and that was during the time of apartheid. And what was happening in the country at that time is, you know, there was a state enforced system of you know, racial segregation and inequality. And I grew up in a small city in the southeast that was known as the Detroit of South Africa, because that's where the whole automobile industry was.
Oh, got it.
So what was happening in South Africa at that time is that, interestingly, people of color had more rights within the workplace than they did in civil society.
Oh, wow.
So as a result, the workplace became, very robust in terms of, trade unionism, a lot of industrial action, a lot of a major fight for worker protections was taking place. And, you know, all of this was pretty much happening on my doorstep because the main industry was just down the road from where I grew up. So it was always in the papers. It was always in the news. And it was something that fascinated me. So that was, I think, my initial interest in HR, which is more from the angle of, employee relations and labor law, was kind of my initial interest. And the local university where I grew up was actually regarded as the best place for human resources, to study human resources management, and particularly those aspects that I mentioned, employee relations and labor law. And many of the faculty actually at that university were the ones that were very much involved in what was going on in the workplace. And they were often mediators when it came to, major strikes and conflicts that were taking place in industry at that time. So that was my initial pull into the world of HR. I think it's only through some years later that as I got exposed to all different types of HR and realizing that it's a broad church and there's so many different aspects to it that I probably got attracted to other parts of HR and particularly sort of the areas of talent acquisition and talent management. But that only came later.
So I want to dive into the professional side, but I want to go back a little bit because you talked a little bit about the social inequality. And I'm always kind of fascinated about when you're in a society like that, and I have to imagine that, you know, you felt like what was going on was, it didn't seem right. Even as a young kid, I imagine that you were seeing things that this type of inequality, but you know, there's a lot of groupthink and there's a lot of divisiveness. So I'm just interested, like culturally growing up in that, like what was your interaction with that? What was your school like? What was, you know, what I try to bring our listeners into what it was like to grow up in South Africa during apartheid.
Yeah, absolutely. I grew up in the sort of 70s and 80s, and just to give a little bit of further context to everyone, the very word apartheid is an Afrikaans word, which is a language that's spoken in South Africa, and it means apartness. And from 1948 up until the early 90s, it was a it was a state-sponsored policy. It was the central policy of the South African government, which ensured that there was complete racial segregation and inequality as well. And it really permeated every part of life. You know, it permeated where you lived. Racial groups had to be completely separated in terms of housing and different areas of cities. It permeated education. It determined where you went to school. It permeated healthcare. It permeated even where you could move around and where you could actually go in society. And it permeated what type of work you could get. There were classifications where people of color could not even get certain types of jobs. And it also permeated who you could love and who you could have a relationship with. There were laws in place for many years where it was illegal to have a relationship with somebody from a different racial group. So, you know, for me growing up in that, I think the one thing to keep in mind is that, you know, the state controlled everything, including the media. And there was a lot of propaganda, as you can imagine, when there's state-sponsored legislation of that nature. So a lot of people, it was very easy for them to believe what they were hearing in the media, that, you know, the government's doing this to protect people from a communist threat. That was always the, that was always sort of the central piece of the propaganda that was in place. And myself, you know, I was fortunate in that, you know, I grew up in a household where my parents were strongly anti-apartheid. They themselves had actually originally met my mother and father at a political rally that was anti-apartheid. And I had the benefit of having a different perspective in my household that was very different to the news that we were fed all the time. And I think that helped me be curious and actually be very critical and of things that I was hearing and really, you know, asking questions and being curious and not accepting anything at face value. You know, and I can remember as a small child, something that really sort of impacted me and my family, you know, really in a really harsh way. You know, we had a maid that worked for us for many years, and the one day we heard a real skirmish breaking out in our back garden, and our maid's husband had decided to come in and visit her. And at that time, if you were a person of color, you were not allowed into a white area unless you actually had a passport on you and you actually had permission to go and move into that area and visit that area and work in that area. That's the only time that you could get a pass to go to another area. And, the police had followed her husband to our house and arrested him and started beating him up like really badly in our own back garden. And, you know, I can remember my mother running out and yelling at them, telling them to stop. And they literally turned around and said, well, if you don't shut up, we're going to hit you too. And they had, you know, whips and they were whipping this poor guy. And I mean, you know, that's a traumatic event and that I can remember clearly to this day. And that was the reality of life in South Africa for many decades.
Yeah, I mean, listen, we look back on segregation and civil rights in the United States. It was only, 1960s where that was still somewhat prevalent here, especially in the southern part of the United States. This is into the 90s. I mean, this is only, 25, 30 years ago in South Africa. You know, I read a book that really resonated with me, another fellow South African and Trevor Noah, called Born a Crime. And it details exactly what you're talking about in terms of his mother and father, right? Were not allowed to be married. They were not allowed to be in love. They had to, be in secret, and they had to very much do things in a very clandestine manner. And I remember reading that book, and I actually come from a mixed background myself. And a lot of the things that he felt in terms of where he fit in, didn't fit in, his friends, the different things that he would see, and the confusion that he had were things that I really, really resonated with me growing up in a very much, different environment and less hostile environment, but still something that really kind of becoming from a mixed culture and background and being exposed to these different cultures you know, was something that was really, really resonant with me. So I just find that time to be fascinating. It's great that your parents recognized that was wrong from an early age. And that's obviously something that has been in your head. And listen, at the end of the day, that's very impactful for who you are and what the professional you become and the person that you become. If you know, I know you mentioned to me that you really are passionate about giving opportunities to people with great potential that maybe come from circumstances that prohibit their ability to reach their potential, much like what we're talking about now in terms of, you know, people in South Africa, you know, people of color. And so I'm just interested, how has that manifested itself in your career? Why is that important to you? Outside of obviously how you were, how you grew up, but I'm interested why it mattered as much for you to be, make it such a big part of who you are in your career.
Yeah. Great question. You know, I think certainly through my upbringing, and then, you know, when I started my career, you know, I started with De Beers in the diamond industry, and for the first 7 years of my career, I was actually in the mining industry in South Africa, and at the time, you know, it was a fascinating time to actually first come into the workplace, because that was at the time when South Africa had transitioned to a democracy after, you know, 40 odd years of apartheid, and all of the legislation was changing. Certainly from an HR perspective, there was a lot, there was a complete change to the labor laws. And a lot more worker protections were coming into place as well. So it was a fascinating time for me to really start my career and start learning. And, you know, one of the benefits of being, you know, going straight from postgrad into De Beers is they had this training program where they, you know, they moved you around in every different part of HR over a period of like 18 months. So I got to work everywhere within that HR department at a diamond mine. And I think it was through my exposure to different parts of HR, and I think particularly the field of learning and development, where that really sort of further sort of instilled that belief that everybody should get a fair shot. And I think I was particularly impressed at, you know, what De Beers were doing to, you know, right the wrongs of the past. And they were investing heavily in training and skills development. And I just saw so many people that had come from, you know, disadvantaged backgrounds that were given and then weren't given an opportunity previously to go to the right schools, were invested in terms of, you know, becoming artisans or going all the way to becoming engineers and mining engineers. And some of the best talent that I got to work with were people that actually came from poor backgrounds and disadvantaged backgrounds that were given a chance, and they, you know, they were taking that chance and making the most of it. And, you know, when I think back to a lot of my colleagues during my De Beers days, many of them actually came from that background and have become some of the most impressive leaders that I've worked with. So I think that further sort of instilled in me this belief that, you know, we should really try to do our best to give everybody the proper opportunity to realize their potential. And I think that stayed with me through my career, because I think as I've worked in so many different parts of HR, the part that I just love the most is maybe the more progressive side of HR, where it's really sort of investing in people and giving them a chance to advance in their careers, giving them a chance to develop skills and knowledge that helps them grow. And I think there's nothing more fulfilling than seeing somebody, you know, take those opportunities and realize their potential.
Yeah. Speaking of, you know, investing in people, you sit on the board of a nonprofit that gives scholarships to impoverished youth in South Africa. Tell us a little bit about the program. And then I know you have a famous alumni that we can, yeah, that we can maybe relate to. So tell us about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So I sit on the board of trustees for a nonprofit that's called Old Grays Americas. It's part of the Gray Foundation. And the high school I went to in South Africa is called Gray High School. And it's a fantastic school. It's semi-private. It's not a fully private school. So I think the beauty of that school is that people that have, you know, that don't come from you know, a very wealthy background can actually go to a school that is simply excellent when it comes to academics and sports and cultural aspects as well. And so the nonprofit that I'm involved in really raises funds for the school so that it can actually continue to do that and attract sort of people that don't always come from a wealthy background. And, you know, often in South Africa, it's, there's a lot of private schools that are, you know, very expensive, and it's difficult for, you know, people that don't have means to go to those schools. So this school in particular, it definitely has a fee structure that is far more inclusive that I think than most schools of its caliber in South Africa. And the nonprofit that I work for sort of really raises funds for the school, and that includes scholarships for kids that come from that come from a poor background. And the alumni that you're referring to is Sia Khaleesi. Sia, I know rugby is a growing sport in the US, but back in South Africa, I would say rugby is probably closer to a religion.
Sure,
it is a sport that is loved by everyone, and it is a fantastic sport that has got a huge following in South Africa. And Sia Khaleesi came from a township in my hometown, a very poor background. I know when he first started playing rugby, he didn't even have money to buy shorts and to buy rugby boots. He came from a really difficult background, and through the nonprofit, he got a scholarship to go to my school. And Sia, became a star rugby player at his time at my school, and he went on to further develop in his career, and he's now the captain of the South African national team.
Wow.
So the South African national team is known as the Springboks. They are pretty much worshipped in South Africa. They are back-to-back world champions, and Sia has been the captain, and he is the face of the team. And for many people, they say he is the face of the new South Africa, and he has played such a critical role in further uniting all these diverse cultures in South Africa. And he's a tremendous leader and a tremendous person, and that gives me a lot of fulfillment that he got that opportunity through the scholarship, went to my school, and has been this incredible leader that has led to not only sort of great success on the field, but great success off the field as well in terms of further uniting the nation.
That's awesome. And who knows if he even gets that opportunity, if not for the scholarship and being able to get the schooling that he did. So that's incredibly admirable. I love that. I love to see people giving back like that. And it's great to have a great success story like that, especially as you bring in new talent into the nonprofit and getting those scholarships. That's an awesome story, Kevin. I want to explore South Africa a little bit because I'm just curious about it out there. And I haven't visited yet. I want to get out there at some point. What do you do for fun when you go back? What's the food and culture like in the biggest cities in South Africa?
Oh, man. I would recommend everybody, they have to go and check out South Africa. It is a naturally beautiful country. I remember going there with the first time I took my wife to South Africa. My wife's Canadian. She'd never been to South Africa before. And when I took her, I tell you what, it was the best trip ever, because I think there's nothing more satisfying than seeing your own country through someone else's eyes. And she, every place that we went to, she was just blown away. She was just like, wow. I remember taking her to the Winelands, which it's the major wine area just outside of Cape Town. And, we spent a day sort of wine tasting and going to all these incredible estates. And, I remember at the end of the day, sitting down, just looking over all these incredible mountain ranges that surround the wine growing area. And I said, okay, so tell me, honestly, how does this compare to Napa? And she was like, this is 1,000 times better.
Whoa, that's amazing. So, Napa is the center of all things wine. That's amazing. So you're saying
yeah, that. And it's, you know, and I think that with South Africa, I think it's got so much natural beauty. Of course, great wildlife. You can go there and enjoy incredible safari. The food is out of this world.
Give me an example. What's a cultural food there? A food that you just love to eat when you go back?
Oh, with the, you know, that there's so many different types of foods there because there's just so many different cultures and so many influences on the cuisine. I'd say the one thing that every culture in South Africa enjoys is what they call braai. It's braai is a South African word for barbecue. So, you know, all types of meats that are out on the braai, everybody loves doing that. You know, steaks, you know, all sorts of seafood as well. You name it. Everybody loves to be outside around the fire, having a braai, enjoying the most delicious meats that you can imagine. There's also, you know, there's also a large Asian community that have come in South Africa that have, you know, originated from places like India and Malaysia. So that has had a big influence on the food. There's some of the best curries I've ever tasted are in South Africa. So if you enjoy a good curry and you like your spice level to be really high, South Africa is the place to go.
Well, I'm half Indian, so I know my way around spice and I know my way around curry. Wine, barbecue, this sounds like a dreamland. I'm going to have to get a ticket and get out there pretty soon. And it sounds like a beautiful place to go visit. So I appreciate you sharing
that. It is. It's got something for everyone. It really does. Whether if you like safari or you like just good foods or you just want to see natural beauty or you actually enjoy to surf, it's got some of the best surfing conditions around the world. I grew up just down the road from Jeffreys Bay or J Bay, as it's known to the locals. And it's one of the best surfing spots in the world. Some of the big competitions are all held there. Some of the world's best beaches. It's all there. There's something for everyone in South Africa. And, you know, and I think with the power of the dollar, it actually stretches very far when you visit South Africa. So it's actually a relatively inexpensive vacation as well.
You know, I'm going through your background. I don't see South African Board of Tourism on here, but you just sold the hell out of that. That sounds like a ideal vacation spot. And my wife has been on me to take her on a safari. So maybe I'll kill two birds with one stone. I'll get out to South Africa, have some barbecue and wine, and let my wife see the lions and elephants and all the things that she wants to see on a safari. That sounds like a great trip. All right, listen, we got to pay the bills here, and we love to talk about hiring. We love to talk about team building. I am personally obsessed with what makes people great at hiring. And so I want to start here. You've done a lot of hiring throughout your career. You advise leaders on hiring. You've done a lot of hiring for your team. If you had to kind of distill down a core hiring philosophy, when I ask you that, what comes to mind?
Yeah. No, I always believe that, you know, when you look at how do you make an organization successful, I think even before you can think about systems and process and operating model and culture, it starts with one thing, you know, get the right people on the bus. And that really underscores the strategic importance of hiring. So I think we're in a place today where it's becoming even more important. It's get the right people on the bus and be very clear about what you want to be hiring for. What's interesting to me is that, you know, in the early parts of my career, you know, I did a lot of training around skills-based hiring, skills-based interviewing. And what's really interesting is that that's making a strong comeback. And I think just with the way that, you know, sort of the world is evolving and, you know, increasingly, I think we're going to be getting into even a more enhanced war for talent over the next 10 to 20 years. Agreed. I think, you know, companies are going to have to be really strategic and focused on what they are hiring for and being very clear on the skills that you need is going to be absolutely essential. I think maybe perhaps over the last sort of 20 years, there's been probably a stronger focus on culture fit as opposed to skills. But I think that's probably shifting more towards sort of skills-based hiring going forward. Not to say that culture fit isn't important, but I think what I've seen certainly over the last few years is that there's an increasing focus on, you know, what are the core skills that we absolutely have to bring into this organization to make us successful. And, you know, knowing that not everybody has got all the skills that you ideally would want, but what are those core skills? And then let's look at sort of investing to develop sort of the additional skills that's going to really set this person up for success.
Yeah, I really love that. I mean, having the right people on the bus is so key. And then the other thing I found is making sure they're on the right seat on the bus is also imperative. In fact, whenever we have somebody that we've gone through a diligent hiring process with or has had success in the past, but is for whatever reason struggling, I always look at the role first. I always look at, are we best taking advantage of this person's ability and skill sets? Did we maybe promote them into a role that really wasn't a great fit for them and they're more comfortable in a previous role and just wanted XYZ instead? I think it's really, really important that not only do you have the right people, but that you have clarity around their role and what you want from them and understanding of what the outputs of those roles. So you can make sure they're in the right job, because there's nothing more frustrating for an individual that is talented, that's had success and is flailing, right, in a role that doesn't maximize their skill set or doesn't take advantage of what they're great at. So I think that's a really important aspect.
I couldn't agree more. You know, one of my favorite stories actually from my De Beers days, where I spent the first 11 years of my career, was exactly that. There was one individual in particular, a business leader that was very talented. I got to know him. I could see what he was capable of, but he was in a role that was, you know, was frustrating to him. He wasn't able to really deploy his strengths as best as he could do within that particular role. And another opportunity came up, which was, you know, a head of one of their business units. And you know, he was a contender amongst many others for this for this business leader role that had opened up. And you know, I with the CFO, I really advocated for him and said, you know what, I believe that he's got what it takes to really knock it out of the park and be great in this role. And you know, after robust interviewing process, the CFO agreed with me, and he got appointed into that role. I mean, this guy revolutionized that business. Wow. And took it to a level that had never been seen before. And some years later, actually won a European Business Award for the innovations that were achieved within this business unit. So I absolutely believe everything that you say around that. I couldn't agree more. Often there is talent that you know, they may not necessarily be in the right role, and but you know, it's almost, you know, often it does happen that you get square pegs and round holes in organizations, and you know, it's really important to try and help them find sort of the right role that is a fit for their strengths. Because, you know, coming back to the whole thing about realizing your potential, if you can find, you know, the right role for them, they can absolutely, you know, astound you with what they can achieve.
I totally agree. I got a question out of curiosity. Did you propose to your wife before, during, or after your time at De Beers?
After.
Okay. So you didn't get a discount on any diamonds for the engagement ring? That's a severe strategic mistake, Kevin.
Well, actually I did, you know, long story short, I actually did get a great discount on a fantastic diamond necklace, which I gave to my mother as a gift. The 1 year, and some years later, she sadly passed, and I got to keep those diamonds that was on a diamond necklace. And then when I met my now wife, I had the diamonds from that necklace sort of taken off the necklace and made into a ring for my wife. So
that's amazing.
It ended up bringing together the two most important women in my life.
I love that. You're out here playing chess and I'm playing checkers. You took care of mom first, and then you ended up taking care of your wife later with the same set of diamonds. I love that. What a great story. What about when I ask you about a memorable interview experience? Maybe it's a time that you interviewed, or maybe somebody you were interviewing. Does anything come to mind when I ask you that?
You know, funny enough, some of the best interview experiences that I've had has actually been around, you know, bringing people into an organization for internship programs. And I know I spent 12 years in the Shiseido Group, and there we had a fantastic program, which was actually bringing in MBA graduates into the organization as well. And what I loved about that process is that it was just so thorough and robust, but still sort of ensured that there was a great candidate experience. So, you know, everybody that was on the interview panel, so to speak, each had a very distinct job on the interview panel. And each person actually focused on different skills that skills or attributes that they were looking for. And so when the candidates sort of went through the interview process, they didn't have any duplication around sort of the questions that they were asked, because they were being asked sort of specifically around sort of certain skills and attributes that was that each member of the interview panel was focused on. So it really resulted in getting a truly holistic perspective on each of those candidates. And you know, I often reflect on that, because it amazes me how many companies, you know, have candidates meeting, you know, sometimes 8, 9, 10 different people within the organization, but then don't clearly differentiate, like, what is each person going to look for? And what happens is that poor candidate literally goes through a repeat every time they have an interview, and they get asked the same questions. So, you know, I often think back to that and think that, you know, often companies should really invest a little bit more time and thought into, you know, if you want somebody to meet a number of stakeholders as part of an interview panel, then just be a little strategic and thoughtful about what each person is going to be looking for.
Yeah, you can invest time, or you can invest in technology. There's some good software out there that is doing exactly that. So I am glad you said that and brought that up. No bias involved at all whatsoever. What about a favorite question? Do you have a favorite question that you love to ask in interviews, and then one that you find to be extremely insightful?
Yeah, I always ask, what is your superpower? So I normally sort of position it as, you know, I believe that everybody has a superpower, and we all have great, everybody's got an inherent talent. And what do you believe is yours? So that's normally how I position it. And the reason I ask that is that it's an opportunity to test for self-awareness. And it's an opportunity to really get the person to talk about sort of their key strengths and how they've deployed those strengths in, you know, in a variety of different contexts. So I always found that a really powerful question. And that's pretty much my the one thing that's consistent no matter what interview that I do.
All right. Well, Kevin, we got to ask you, what's your superpower?
So my superpower is... I think more than anything else, my superpower is being able to understand a complex business environment and be able to translate that in clear, simple terms to internal stakeholders and the teams that I lead. So often it's been able to see sort of the being able to connect the dots, and then communicate that and articulate that to the people that I lead to help them understand where their place is in really sort of driving success for a business.
Wow. All right. I'm going to answer the question myself too. So I will pick a superpower I have. That's going to be a little bit sound cliche, but I'll explain. I'm going to say it's my empathy and my ability to communicate through empathy. And why I will say that is because I do feel very strongly that I can put myself in my customer's shoes and understand exactly what they want and what they need, or when they're in a challenging situation, how to address it and solve the problem for them. I can do that with my employees, right? I can understand where their point of view is, how they might have reacted or responded or something, or taken something a certain way, and then be able to speak to that, right? I can do it with our vendors. I can do that with, you know, my family and relationships. I think it's a really important key to be able to not just look at things through your worldview and perspective, but look through others. And that way you can influence, you can communicate, you can understand, you can build a deeper connection when you have that understanding rather than just constantly looking at something from your purview. So I would say that that is one of the things that I pride myself in and continually work on, because I think it's been a very impactful thing in terms of success in any type of professional or business endeavors. All right.
I love that. That's an important one. And just to add to that, Oz, you know, when I think about the world of talent acquisition, and I've led many sort of internal talent acquisition teams, and you know, I see the function really increasingly becoming a strategic talent partner to the business. And that strength that you speak to is absolutely so critical, because if you can have that sense of curiosity and if you can have that sense of empathy, it is just so powerful what you can unearth when you really get a deep understanding of the role that you're recruiting for. I think that is a critical one.
I love that. And you know, I think those two words go together a lot more than they're given credit, empathy and curiosity, because you can only get to a point of empathy if you're curious and you want to understand how people feel and what they think, and you ask a lot of questions. And so one begats the other in a lot of ways. So I think that's a great tie-in that you did there. Let me ask you, what about when you miss on somebody? Because we've all missed on somebody, you know, throughout our career. is there anything that you look back on that you like, you notice a theme or regret? Like when you miss, why does it usually happen?
Yeah, great question. And as much as we've become, you know, better and better at selection, you know, there's both an art and a science. And, you know, this let's just say the science has got better, but there's always going to be an aspect around sort of interviewing and selection, which is maybe sort of more in the more in the side of the art. And I think when there's been a miss, it's when, you know, there are people that are really great at interviewing and they are really strong communicators. And even though you might take them through a great experience and it's robust and it's thorough, they can still, to a degree, you know, really skilled people in this domain can game the system somewhat. And I think that's where I've seen misses, certainly in my experience, where, you know, you think you're getting, you know, the right person on the bus, but, you know, after a few weeks or months, you realize like, wow, where was that person that we interviewed? They've just absolutely wowed us every step of the way, but they're not bringing the goods. And that's often where I've seen a miss, and I don't know what the perfect answer to that is, but I think that will always be sort of there will always be a degree of risk in a talent acquisition process, and I think that's certainly one of them.
Yeah, I think a lot of times what it comes down to is, you know, essentially being able to interview well is not necessarily always application to what you're going to do in the job. And some people are really great at interviewing. And then when it comes to the actual work, either the motivation's not there or the fit's not there, whatever it may be. And sometimes you get, you know, something less than what you thought you purchased, right? In terms of when you offered the person and brought them on board. So I do think that's an important distinction. To me, I would continually try to make it as scientific as possible. And not that I'm like this big analytics nerd, but at the end of the day, like, I do think that most of this stuff can be codified. I do think our gut intuition comes from places like experiences or PTSD you had when a situation didn't work out or something you read or saw, right? And if you can figure out what that is rather than just calling it a gut instinct, then you're going to be able to repeat it and you're going to be able to understand it. You're going to be able to get to the root of it. So I try more and more to get to the point of, okay, I have a feeling here, but why do I have this feeling? Does this remind me of something I've seen previously? Does this remind me of something I read about? And if I can get to the root of that, then I'm usually more able to kind of ascertain what's real and what's not. And so that can be difficult, but I think it's worth the effort. What do you do to prepare for an interview? Do you do anything unique or special? Like do you just come in there, you're ready to go, review the resume a second before, or do you put in any legwork beforehand before you get into the interview?
Certainly, you know, two things that I always do before interviewing someone, I always check out their LinkedIn profile. You know, I don't always just look for the obvious. I also look for, you know, things that just give me a clue as to, you know, what are they like as a person? So are they featured on anything? Have they been on, you know, things like podcasts or panels? And often you can find that on LinkedIn as well. Also, what are their hobbies and interests? And what do their recommendations say? That's something that I'll always do. And then certainly review the resume. And I do my best to sort of review that well before the time and come prepared with questions where I'm, you know, I think if you do a good review of a resume before the time, it will naturally sort of throw up questions and areas to probe. And I think that for me, that's table stakes. You know, anybody that's interviewing has to do that, you know, before the time and come prepared. So those are the two things that I will always, always do as part of my preparation.
Yeah, I love that. Last hiring question. So we all know that candidate experience is really important. You're giving them a little bit of a insight into your soul, your company's soul, what they'll be working with. Do you do anything unique to enhance candidate experience? Is it just doing the small things well? Like, what have you seen throughout your career, either yourself or other or the companies you've worked at, done, you know, great things to create a great candidate experience?
Yeah. So I think trying to find ways to give a personal touch, I think is really critical in ensuring a great candidate experience. You know, one example, unfortunately, this didn't happen to me, but it happened to a good friend. And this example sticks with me to this day. But, you know, he was in final rounds with a particular company that was actually in the coffee and beverage industry. And after he had his final interview, he got home, and you know, on his doorstep was a hamper from the organization with all of their like coffees and teas and goodies that was in a hamper. And in it was a personal written card, which was, you know, like, "Hey, Bill, thank you so much for taking the time, you know, to spend with us. We love talking to you," you know, just real personal touch, personal card, you know, those type of things like really, really go, you know, they go the extra mile. You know, what I would also, on that theme of personal touch, not only through the sort of through the interviewing process, but also what I've seen that is almost that bridge to onboarding when a candidate joins an organization is really thinking about sort of personalization there. And what I've seen some companies do really well is, you know, like maybe a couple of weeks before the person joins the team, there's a you know, personalized video that's created by the team that they're joining. And, you know, each person for, you know, 20 seconds is just saying like, "Hey, you know, we are so excited for you to come and join us." And, you know, and a little sort of personal message from each person. And I've actually even seen companies do that where somebody is undecided between offers that they might have received. And it's the company that actually sent the personalized video that actually had a number of business leaders saying like, "This is why you are going to be so important to us. And this is going to be the cool work that you're going to be doing. And we really, really would be excited if you decided to join us." That was literally the deciding factor for, you know, in one case sort of that I'm aware of, where somebody was kind of going, "Wow, I've got two great offers. Where do I go?" And it was the company that really provided that extra little level of personalization that made the difference. And he accepted their offer.
That's why candidate experience is so important. If we have that war of talent on there, those little things can make all the difference between getting somebody that's an absolute game changer, needle mover, and you know, getting your second choice or your third choice or whatever it may be. All right, have fun with me here a little bit. I'm going to ask you a little bit of a curveball. Celebrity, fictional, nonfiction, whatever it is, any person you can pick throughout history or current times that you would work with, you think you would work amazingly well with this person, right? And accomplish amazing things professionally. Who comes to mind when I ask you that?
Woo. Okay. That is a curveball, but there are some individuals, you know, some celebrities. I mean, you mentioned Trevor Noah earlier. And I mean, I absolutely love that guy. I know I'm biased because I'm South African, but he's, you know,
super intelligent, worldly, funny, right? Can break humor into a tense meeting, maybe. Yeah, I like that.
Absolutely. And I mean, also very sort of different thinking. You know, I've seen him do stand up. I mean, of course, I've seen him do so many shows on TV as well. But like the way he thinks about issues is often quite different to the norm. And he's able to sort of shed a light on, you know, current issues in quite a different way and helps people think about things differently. So I think that's a real superpower from Trevor Noah. Certainly other people that I would instinctively
I got one for you. All right, we'll go to another South African. Do you think that you could work with or for Elon Musk?
I'm on the fence there.
Okay, tell us why. What's good and what's bad?
I'm on the fence. There's no doubt that he is an incredible genius. His IQ, no doubt, is off the charts. I think what I appreciate about Elon is that he's got a tolerance for risk that is... I think he's unparalleled.
It's the thing I admire the most about him. His tolerance for risk is amazing. That's why he's had such grand, you know, wins and triumphs and successes, because he's willing to put all his chips on the table.
Oh, totally. I mean, he's not afraid of failure. He is so sort of resilient and persistent in terms of achieving what he wants to do. So I really do admire him for that. I think on the flip side, it's the EQ aspects that worry me about Elon. I don't know if he's maybe had things going on in his life in the last few years, but his propensity to troll people and be unnecessarily mean.
Antagonistic,
that gives me, you know, pause for concern. I don't know if I would... necessarily like to be on the receiving end if I work for him.
I think that's totally fair. If he wasn't the CEO and founder, you might not hire him, because he's the kind of person that might disrupt the apple cart a little bit. But you know, the good sides are the vision, the risk appetite, the genius, you know, ideas and innovation. So yeah, there's good and bad to everybody. So great. I appreciate you playing along with me on that. Let's take it a little bit of a different direction. I want to get in, I want to hear about some of the things that maybe you've read or maybe some good content you've seen recently. Our listeners are very well read. They love to watch TV, listen to music. Anything that you'd recommend or something that you've read or seen recently that stood out to you?
Yeah, I've lately been binging The Bear, the show on TV.
Okay,
on Hulu.
Me too.
Yeah,
right?
And I got into it pretty late. You know, I kind of sort of started hearing the harp and I was like, okay, I'm curious. Maybe I should check this out. And I got to say, first couple of episodes, I was incredibly uncomfortable watching it. You know, it's brilliant what they do. It's in the kitchen. It's high pressure. There's lots of conflict. There's, you know, people, kind of losing it and in each other's faces in the kitchen. And I was like, oh, wow. I don't know. This is a little intense for my liking, but you got to stick with it because I think it's probably one of the best series that I've seen where you really have such depth behind each of the characters and you really get to, I certainly fell in love with all the characters. You know, at first I thought they were like, you know, hard and mean and unnecessarily sort of, antagonistic.
Yeah.
But when you start understanding sort of their story, and what they're about, and you start seeing some vulnerability around each of the characters. It really draws you in, to that story. And you know, and there's a lesson in it for all of us because it's, you know, don't be too quick to judge. And I think that's particularly important if you're in the people business.
Yeah, we look at the outcome and the output, but the story of how they got there, the experience of how they got there, is sometimes more important than even what you're getting as an output. And what I find great about the show, and I got into it a little bit later too, I watched it with my wife. I'm saying yes, chef, to her in the kitchen all the time. but I just think that they do a great job of character development, but also, like, I think visually and editing wise, like, they do a really good job of like putting you in the kitchen and making you feel the intensity. I've never worked in a 5-star restaurant or a Michelin star restaurant, but I've worked in places and those are hectic. I can only imagine what it's like when the expectation and the bar is so high for restaurants. Like that. And also one of my favorite books, Unreasonable Hospitality, Will Goddard, who is a producer on the show. He did a lot of the consulting on some of the practices they do from a hospitality perspective. So there's just a lot of things about that show. I caught on a little bit late to it. Plus, I'm a big Chicago guy. So I love Chicago and I love to see the backdrop of the city. So great, great recommendation. All right. We're going to end here. I want to ask a question for you really about some advice that you would give your 20-year-old self, stuff that you know now, but you didn't know then. What would you tell your 20-year-old self in terms of advice?
Yeah. Don't sweat the small stuff, you know, and don't sweat your perceptions of what you think people think of you. Listen to your moral compass. You do your best to do good, work hard, stay focused, and you'll be fine. And I think often, you know, my younger self, like so many, sort of friends and family as well. You know, I think sometimes we're, especially when we're younger, we're a little bit constrained by our perceptions of failure and what others might actually think of us and what we might, you know, what we might be saying or doing and how we might be perceived. And I think maybe that's the benefit of getting older and wisdom, which is like, it's okay. You know, it's okay. I think as long as you continually work on yourself and you've got a very strong idea of what is your moral compass and what are your own personal values, that's what needs to guide you. Don't worry about anything else.
Fantastic advice. Kevin, I really appreciate you coming on. We're going to have to get together in person soon and drink some South African wine together.
Absolutely.
Super insightful. I appreciate you sharing and opening up about your youth and growing up and all your insights on hiring. Thank you so much for coming in. Second season has kicked off, so you are our first guest. So I'm very appreciative of that as well. I hope everybody considers supporting us by subscribing or leaving a comment or some stars on there and continue to listen to the show. So thanks again for coming on, Kevin. Really appreciate you.
Have a good one. Great to join you. Thanks, Oz.
Talk to you.